Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and I'm joined once again by a comics artist and illustrator who's led comics workshops for kids and collaborated with writers and nonprofit organizations for projects that he calls illustrated narratives. Lately, he's been working on a personal project, a graphic biography, and it's an unusual book, to say the least. Ryan Alexander Tanner, welcome back to Words and Pictures.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Have I been on the show, your show, the most of anyone? I think this is my fourth time on this show.
I think Bill Plimpton is about double your record. Yeah,
right.
But we've had you on the show a number of times. You've been joined by fellow artist Farrell Dalrymple and author and activist Bill Ayers. Good to have you appearing solo.
Yeah, I think this is our first one-on-one, so we'll see how it goes.
Good, make it count.
I'm just smiling for those of you who are listening on the radio. Just smiling.
Okay, we mentioned illustrated narratives. These are collaborations that you've done as an artist with educators, with psychologists, health advocates, even with war correspondent David Axe.
Yeah, it's just a thing I've sort of learned how to do. I think it has to do with my interests and that I always sort of treated comics as a platform for communication. You know, that's what I always think of it as primarily, not just telling stories, but conveying information too. And I like working with people, and just a big part of my adult learning has been doing these projects. So just working with experts and things like that about getting their messaging together. It really, I think, clicked with me when I did the To Teach book with Bill Ayers, because we spent so much time taking that book apart and putting it back together, sort of going like, okay, if you take all the language out, like what are just the essential ideas, and you kind of take it apart and turn it into a bullet list of like, what are we trying to say? And once you know that, you can present it however you want. And then that's where the kind of the creative endeavor comes in.
Yeah, let me mention that Bill Ayers, who you mentioned, he's a retired professor of education and a famous member of the Weather Underground. And he originally wrote a book called To Teach, and you worked with him on the comics version. And it was, like you said, and like Bill said at the time, it was a total reworking of the concept of his original text version of the book.
Yeah, I mean, his book was just a bunch of ideas, you know, and there was some narrative elements like or anecdotes and things, but there wasn't anything that really made it seem to me like it should be a graphic novel. So we had to kind of work out like what ties it all together. But also, I mean, everyone should get to do that, like just get to sit down with an author and go through a book they've read and just like break it down like that. That was such like an enriching experience. I loved doing that. I mean, I would do that a million times. Especially someone who's really an expert. I mean, there's so many concepts from that book that I've applied to like everything ever since, you know, just like non-hierarchical teaching and just the way collaboration works, you know. But I think the thing that probably ties all of this stuff together, because my work is a little eclectic, I would say, but it's just I have some kind of a brain that is like very stimulated by sort of processing information and recreating it in comics. There's just something wrong with me that's just something I want to do. I don't know.
Your art is all handmade with brush and ink on paper. You're old school.
I'm pretty old school. Yeah. I now do pencils on the iPad. So I'm a little bit of a mix of them, but yeah, I just, that sensation of inking on paper with a brush, I can't get that from an iPad or it's just like, that's my favorite part of the whole thing. Like, I love that. And then, yeah, I still hand letter everything. I just like it so much better. Like, I can see digital lettering that is digital and it doesn't look good to me.
But anyway, no generative AI for you.
No, I mean, I'm scared of that stuff. I like to think it's just a tool, you know, a little bit like everyone was freaking out when Photoshop came out, you know, like it's still a tool. And I think AI stuff's going to look like AI stuff. But I mean, I've been having conversations, you know, I'll probably never get paid, you know, $300 to draw like a flyer for a music show ever again or anything. You know, like I think some stuff is just going to be gone. I myself have done, you know, had some logo work that's worked out well for me. stuff like that might just be gone. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's going to be worse for copywriter. I mean, it's going to kill a bunch of people's jobs, and I don't know what that's going to mean. We're in a moment with that where we don't quite know how bad it's going to be, which is sort of the tone of January 17th, 2025. We're not quite sure how bad it's going to be. It's going to be bad.
The thing I'm wondering about is, like, young artists coming up in the world, are they going to want to spend the time mastering their craft? Like, old heads like us have spent hours and hours and hours mastering our craft. Is there going to be like, are you going to be discouraged from that? Same for writers. It's like, well, that's just a sucker's game to do that when you can just be an influencer or whatever.
Yeah, I really don't know. I mean, I don't know. I'm middle-aged now and you're even older than me, so we don't know anything, but I think things will always change, and the older people always think it's going to hell, and in some ways be right, and in some ways just not be up to date on. I mean, I don't know though too. Like, we speak ill of AI, like this Muhammad Ali book. So I did a comics biography of Muhammad Ali, right? So hard to draw; it takes forever. I finished the first volume; the second volume's even longer. So I'm a little bit stuck logistically, and I've had the thought of, like, oh, I could probably feed an AI, whatever they're called, this first 150 pages and give it the layouts for, maybe I can make it draw it for me, or I could fix it up. I mean, I probably would not do that, but the thought has occurred to me because it's just emulating my own work. I probably would not actually do that. But I mean, it's also true the amount of labor that goes into making comics is totally absurd. Like, why are we doing this? It's foolish.
Well, going back to handmade art, there's something very important about getting your muscles, your whole body into your art. And, when you're working with kids, I'm sure your own kids are learning about hand-eye coordination and using these old tools. I mean, that's a great way to get that going.
Yeah, I mean, my kid, we definitely sit down. She wants to draw pictures for each other is a big thing. That's funny too. My wife is a nurse practitioner, and she does a lot of work dealing with pregnancy and addiction. She's a really smart person, she's doing some really important work. But she also paints and draws, and I mean, she does everything. She plays music and stuff. Like, I've never had any variety in my creative endeavors at all, but she's very much like can do a little. Anyway, our kid will have us drawing like Elsa and Anna and Minnie Mouse and stuff. And I always tell her, like, not all the parents can do this. This isn't just like something your parents can do. Like, your parents have a specific thing that they can do here. So hopefully she'll learn to appreciate that. We'll see. So I went to SPX last year. I noticed there was kind of a division between people with and without kids. Like, all the people without kids were like, oh, I'm gonna go on a retreat and make a zine. They're all using their freedom to do idealistic things, and a lot of the parents are like, how are you doing this? How are you gonna keep this going? And we're pretty much all married to someone who's got it together, who's got a better job than. I mean, I've always been very career oriented. I've really treated this as a career as well as an art form, so I've done pretty okay. I mean, I've always paid my part of things, and I was on my own for a long time, so I'm not a bum or anything, but I don't make what a nurse makes,
Well, you're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, SW Conser, and we're talking today with illustrator and comics artist Ryan Alexander Tanner. His latest project is Muhammad Ali, the greatest comics biography of all time. All right, so let's talk about Muhammad Ali, the greatest comics biography of all time.
I'd love to, yeah.
You've got two volumes of this book plotted out. And they're more or less divided between the Cassius Clay years and the Muhammad Ali years.
Yeah, I actually had the idea for this right after I finished to teach, which a lot has changed. That was like 15 years ago. And I picked Muhammad Ali for a bunch of reasons. I mean, I think the main thing for me was just him as a political figure, that he refused to fight in the Vietnam War. And that he just really lived his ideals in this way, that he spoke truth to power and he stood up for what he believed in this really meaningful way and at a meaningful time too. And then also there's things like boxing translates really, really well to comics. Like I was very interested in that, of drawing boxing matches, and that you have these fights, which are almost like traditionally what you'd think of in something you do in comics, but they also are meaningful. Like there's always a stake in it, and there's always like more happening than just, look at this cool fight. It's like there's a larger narrative purpose to these matches that are happening. So, and then I read one book about him, and I just got more and more hooked, you know. And I think around 2015-ish, I in earnest was like, okay, I'm gonna really go all in on this. And I spent like 2 years just reading material every single day, and then another year or so just making a million outlines and figuring out the content and where it goes and stuff, you know, and getting different sources. And I wrote three or four drafts. And then I think I started sitting down to actually draw this in like probably 2019 or something. So it became two books because it's just too big a project.
You've been releasing the chapters as individual comics, right? Have you gotten some feedback from that?
Oh, yeah, a lot. I started a Patreon. So I've been doing that for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. So I did five chapters. Yeah. I mean, and I've done a lot of critical review. I mean, you know, Muhammad Ali is a figure, a historical figure in, you know, the African-American cultural lexicon and things like that. I did a lot of peer review and sending it out and deep thinking about it.
Yeah, because, I mean, you're a skinny white boy from Oakland. You don't feel the need to stay in your own demographic lane. So do you get people who just say, hey, you should be leaving this story to somebody else?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been all white people who've told me that. And I am from Oakland. So I don't know. I mean, so this is the big issue, right? I mean, I've spent too much time talking about this through the course of this, and it's all been white people grilling me. I mean, I think it's unique in Portland, Oregon, too, because it's so white here, and there's this, like, wish to be progressive, but it's so inexperienced. I mean, that's a whole long thing, but I came here when I was 20, you know. I thought half of the United States was black because that's what everything had looked like to me, at least half the people I went to school with. So to me, talking about Muhammad Ali is sort of, I think, in a lot of ways, the result of I didn't learn black American history from white liberals. I learned it from black women who were my teachers and from people in my class. So it was something that was really ingrained into my upbringing, and I am white and have remained so. I think that questioning this is good, and I think that the tools of evaluating the work, that's where I've gotten frustrated. I mean, I've had in this experience of trying to get this book, like a larger publisher could pay me to finish this book. And I've been told really very straightforward ways, like, because you are white, we are not comfortable with this. And in a few cases, there were actually black folks in comics who were pretty well known who saw this book and helped me approach a publisher with it. And the white publisher told them, because I'm white. So do what you will with that information. But it's fundamentally true that we live in a racist society. We have a deep history of racism in the United States and of white exploitation of black people and their narratives and these things. So that's something, and I don't know if just me being aware of that is enough. I mean, and I don't know, it's been a few years now since the uprising happened, but if we really are talking about equity, I think we should actually be talking about changing systems rather than just saying, like, only black people can write about black people, but maybe you should have more black people running publishing companies who can have the ability to evaluate the work. Maybe we should have more black people working in government who are writing policy and things like that. I think a lot of this stuff has been kind of for show, or like putting a band-aid on a big open wound. I mean, I don't know. I don't get to answer it ultimately, but I would invite anyone to read the work, and I would invite any conversation. You know, I mean, like Malcolm X is in this book. If you're really getting pretty serious about what you're talking about here, there's conversations to be had, but I would invite those conversations, and I have invited those conversations.
So there's a huge amount of research behind this project, just many, many books, but you've also, in the credits, you mention Linguistic Consultation by Dennis Preston, Adjunct Professor of Linguistics, University of Kentucky. Tell me about that.
So that came from, I had the great privilege of getting to share this work with Eve Ewing early on, whose opinion is very powerful to me. And she was really supportive. She said, it's obvious that you're, you know, doing this for the right reason and that you're being respectful of the material. And she said, there was a little bit of phonetic spelling in the first draft of the first chapter, which to me is just, I like phonetic spelling, like as describing dialect or something. And she said, I feel a little weird about that. I'm just going to tell you, like, made me feel a little bit weird. And for me, I was like, oh, it's the 50s and it's Louisville, Kentucky. Like, I don't know anything about the South and I wasn't around in the 50s. So some of the specifics of language I was feeling like I needed to do some quality research on. And there's not like, you can't just like buy a book about, you know, 1950s Louisville dialect, you know? So, I did some reaching out and I ended up getting in touch with Dennis Preston, who's been really, I really like him. And he did a thing, you've probably done things like this when people approach you for projects where you go, okay, here, read this. And if this clicks with you, then I think we can work together. And he gave me an article and it was essentially about how, you know, he's a language nerd, you know, like I'm a comics nerd, he's a language nerd. And the article is essentially about how historically, in the process of transcription, that Black folks' spoken dialogue is written phonetically more than, you know, white people. And it's that there's some bias in that, you know, that it's almost evaluative of what they're saying. And anyway, it just basically was like, don't write phonetically because it can seem condescending. And so that rule, just some basic like rules of how this will sit with people, but also just like phrases, you know, like on the first page, young, you know, 10-year-old Cassius Clay is showing his bike off. And I wanted to use some specific phrase there, but I didn't know one. And he says about the bike, she good looking, ain't she? Which is, I never heard that phrase in my life, but Dennis Preston was like a 10-year-old Black kid in Louisville in 1954. That's what he'd say about his bike. So this is helpful.
So you mentioned that you didn't want to have narration. You wanted to have dialogue. That said, in the versions that you've been putting out, you have these footnotes, news and notes from behind the scenes after each chapter. So you're putting all the information that people might have questions about at the end of each chapter and pointing out where something is a quote, where something's fabricated, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that felt essential, especially if, you know, presented as a biography, because, you know, standard text biographies aren't like creating narrative scenes in order to, I mean, they are a little bit, but you'll get like three snippets of lines or something. Well, and there is in each chapter, there's like a one page caption narrated breakdown of something. That was like sort of the compromise I made. And that came from peer review of people going like, I want to know just a little bit more about this. And there wasn't like a authentic feeling way, you know, you're not going to have 10-year-old Muhammad Ali and his dad going like, so we live in the West End, in the history of the West End, you know, so it's like, okay, we're going to have one page to kind of just give you a little more information that the author wants you to have. But yeah, and then at the end, I just thought it was really important to peel back the screen or whatever and just really clarify. Like, I kind of had the idea that this book, like a kid in middle school could read this book and give a really good report on Muhammad Ali at the end. So I wanted to be clear, like what I had written and what was actually said. And then the further you go in the story, the more and more stuff was really documented. Like, there's some really private moments in Muhammad Ali's life where there's like two reporters sitting in the room, you know, like his second marriage fell apart in a hotel room and there was like people sitting there who saw it. But also there's a lot of like at the beginning of, I think, the third chapter, he has this confrontation with Sonny Liston in a casino. And you can read one book that's an oral history and get three different versions of that story where someone will go, oh, he slapped him. And then they'll go, oh, no, he didn't slap him. He did this, you know, depending on, because memory is also like, so you got some wiggle room there. In the movie, Sonny Liston fires a gun at him. But the point of that true story is that Cassius Clay went up and was hassling Sonny Liston in sort of a PR kind of a way, you know, promoting this fight they're going to have. And Sonny Liston wasn't having it and got up in Cassius Clay's face. And he was very intimidating. It's also saying like, this guy is actually like a scary guy. that he's up against. It's kind of creating stakes for that fight. So that part is true. And then the details you can kind of negotiate or going, you know, like I really didn't want to put words in Malcolm X's mouth. So he's basically like just about everything he says that's not like, you know, ordering coffee or something is something from a speech or from his autobiography or from an interview. So it's just that. It's like, okay, Cassius Clay and Malcolm X hung out a lot. They would eat at these restaurants, get reference to the restaurant, have a scene that shows they have this relationship, and then take a bunch of quotes about Cassius Clay that Muhammad Ali said and tweak them a little bit. So he's saying them to Cassius Clay. And so it's just like this collage of quotes. So, and then I think you should explain that to the reader if you're doing that, you know, so they kind of know exactly where this is coming from and what's definitely true and not. Nothing's not true. Everything is true that happens in this book, but it didn't all happen exactly as it's recreated.
Yeah, we mentioned before Muhammad Ali, he was born Cassius Clay. So your first volume is more or less the Cassius Clay story. Yeah, in your version, he's coming up in the boxing world when he meets the wrestling legend Gorgeous George. And although young Cassius, he's already at this point a natural performer. He's got a theatrical flair.
Yeah.
You show the meeting with Gorgeous George as a real turning point in Cassius's personal presentation.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Muhammad Ali said when everyone said, like, why didn't you start doing that stuff where you predicted rounds and you were saying all this stuff about people? He said, I got that from Gorgeous George. Gorgeous George also, who I never heard of before this, also is credited for James Brown's hair and cape. James Brown also credits Gorgeous George, this
wow
professional wrestler that would be forgotten by history if not.
Yeah, Gorgeous George was an early heel. You know, in
yeah.
wrestling, you had the faces who you were supposed to cheer and the heels who you were supposed to boo.
Yeah, he'd do his hair up and he would make his like manager spray perfume into the ring before you'd get in. And just this really over the top theatricality. And that didn't exist in box. A lot of things didn't exist in boxing before Cassius Clay showed up. So, yeah, I mean, it wasn't my interpretation of anything. It was just like, that's what Muhammad Ali said. So, and then again, there's like really, really clear recounts of this event. So it's just based pretty much exactly on what he said happened. You know, like everything Gorgeous George said, it's not like a quote a reporter wrote down, but it's what Muhammad Ali says he said. But yeah, just that idea that like people can love you or hate you, but you just want them to see that. That's another thing too that's really important in this first volume to capture that's maybe a little uncomfortable for people is people really hated Cassius Clay's guts. They hated him. A lot of it was because he was a young black man and he was totally proud of himself and outspoken about it. And that was like really social taboo at that time. And you have to share that when you're telling this story, you know, whether or not it makes someone in 2025 uncomfortable, that's our history. That's some hard truth. That's he wasn't just a heel. I mean, there was that too, like in the theatricality of boxing as sport, but it was really pushing this cultural boundary that deserved to be pushed.
Yeah, and over all the decades of Ali's life, I mean, his politics were all over the place. You know, he was an early figure to condemn the Vietnam War, but later he toned it down. I seem to remember back in the 1980s, Ali and a couple of other boxers posing for a billboard that endorsed Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, he didn't. That's actually the only thing I intentionally left out is that he endorsed Ronald Reagan, which I was like, oh, I'm just not gonna. But yeah, I mean, he did all this kind of global peace ambassador work later in life. He went to Iraq and met with Saddam Hussein and got him to release American hostages. And he went to Cuba and brought medical supplies. He was just doing all this kind of quiet stuff that was like humanitarian work that's not controversial. But he did use his fame and notoriety to like get a hospital built and do charitable work and bring medical supplies to countries that didn't have, like he was, you know, arguably that was his most heroic stuff. It's just not glamorous. But he also didn't always scrutinize causes he was involved in and things like that. You know, he was sort of an easy mark for some scams that happened and things like that. You know, like he'd get involved in a foundation that would end up embezzling money or something. Like he got people stole from him a lot. And so, you know, I mean, but his intentions were great. And I think this is messy too. And I don't, because there were things that are my interpretation that I had in my mind when I was making this, but I didn't present them as really as anything. They're just my, like, I think that a lot of the big theatricality was anxiety. And I don't know that to be true, but that's what I would relate to is like, oh, I'm going to go up and, you know, say all this stuff and cause this hoopla. And it's just a way of like dealing with my nerves because I have to fight this guy in front of everyone, you know? But I don't know if that's true or not. And another one is there's this question of like Muhammad Ali fights the system, he fights the man, you know, and did he win or did the man get him? And I kind of feel like towards the end of his career, they did kind of get him because wealth and fame will do that to you. It'll soften you up and it'll compromise your, I mean, I don't think he compromises beliefs because he does so much cool stuff after he retires, you know. But he, I remember reading an essay a long time ago in this art book, The Interventionists, you know, and that's how we take down, you know, Jack Kerouac or Che Guevara is we put them on a mouse pad, we put them on a t-shirt and make them a meaningless symbol. And I don't know. I think it's open for discussion how much that happened to Muhammad Ali, but his contributions and his anti-establishment ways were really important. And he did some cool stuff to the very end, but he also was pretty comfortable for the last long portion of his life. So I don't know. But I didn't really present that as an argument either way. I just, it's just something I thought about.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, SW Conser, and we've been talking today with illustrator and comics artist Ryan Alexander Tanner. His latest project is Muhammad Ali, the greatest comics biography of all time. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And we'll probably we'll come out again next year when the to teach, you know, get make this an annual event. I'll try. I'm gonna catch up with Bill Plimpton. I mean, it's up to you, of course.
Well, for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, where would they look?
I got a website. It's ohyesverynice.com. My name is too long to be like a handle, so ohyes verynice.com. And you can go on Kickstarter right now and buy this book. You can go to, you just search Muhammad Ali on Kickstarter to come right up. And if this first volume does very well, I'll make volume. And volume two is kind of the stuff people want. You know, it's when he says he won't fight in Vietnam and he's in exile and all the fights with, you know, the rumble in the jungles in volume two and all the fights with Joe Frazier. And if you want to live a fulfilling life, I would buy this book.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.